Blog Talk Radio.
UR Tennis is an advocacy group for underrepresented tennis participants. These participants would include players, parents, coaches, and the learners of all racial minorities, all social class minorities, all sexual minorities, all age-related minorities, and anyone who seems to have been forgotten. Our mission is to act as the voice for tennis. We are striving to bring forth programs, contests, issues, news, education, and philanthropy that will benefit all in tennis. We are seeking active participation from populations that believe they have an interest in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We want to expand our outreach royally, regionally, nationally, and worldly. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to continuously be talked about, and we will pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon, tennis world. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, to the UR Tennis Network, to the Bruce Lipka Show. I'm Bruce Lipka, coming to you today live from our nation's capital here on Thursday, December the 13th. Today on our show, we are honored to have both Paul Goldstein and his father, Clark Goldstein. We're going to jump real quick to a commercial, and then when we come back, we're going to be live with the father and the son of who many people feel is the greatest junior player in U.S. tennis history. Stay with us.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
All right, folks, welcome back to the show here today on Blog Talk Radio on the UR Tennis Network. This is Bruce Lipka on the Bruce Lipka Show, and we have with us today, live coming to you, we have Paul Goldstein. Paul, are you here with us?
You bet.
And we've got his father, Clark Goldstein. Clark, you here with us?
I'm here.
All right. You know, we've had folks over the last weeks, guys, who have a lot of questions about junior tennis and college tennis and parents and what's the parents' role look like and what's the tennis family look like. And I thought, well, I don't think there's a better tennis family that I've ever heard of, so we bring you guys in, and we welcome you to the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Our
pleasure to be with you.
Okay. Why don't we, you know, jump in, and I like to, you know, I like to take things through a chronology there, guys, and at any point you want to jump in and say something, feel free, but, you know, Clark, tell us first about Paul's introduction to tennis and, you know, how it happened, and, you know, then, Paul, you tell us a little bit about you know, how it looked from your end.
Well, when Paul was growing up, he had two brothers that loved to play sports, so Paul got into sports at a very young age. And we lived around the corner from a school, and somehow Paul got a tennis racket and a tennis ball and started hitting the tennis ball against the wall of the school. And he did it for a while, and we didn't pay much attention to it. And then one day he came to us and said, you know, I think I'd like to take tennis lessons. So between my wife and I, we didn't know anything about tennis really. So we found a tennis pro who said that she'd be glad to teach Paul. Her name was Nancy Ornstein. And so Paul started taking lessons from Nancy. And I guess he was about 9 years old when he started, and, you know, or maybe a little bit younger. And then Nancy told us one day after taking lessons with for Paul for a couple weeks, you know, I think that if I could coach him for a year, he could be the best 10 and under tennis player in the Washington area. Well, being a salesman, I thought she was a pretty good salesman, but we decided to stick with her anyways. And sure enough, that's how Paul got started.
Paul, when you started hitting on the wall there, what were you thinking about? Were you thinking this was just another sport, or is this something that you really wanted to pursue?
Farmland Elementary School, remember it well. You know, my dad had it right. I had two older brothers who were athletic that I looked up to, and all I wanted to do was compete with them. All I wanted to do was play with their friends, and so you know, that's how I think I got my competitive spirit when I'm hitting that ball against the wall. At that point, you know, it's just activity and something I was really enjoying doing. When I started following a little bit of tennis, I would pretend that I was Yvonne Lendl playing against Yannick Noah or Jimmy Connors or McEnroe, whoever it was. And you know, every time I hit one, I'd say, there's Lendl and then and Connors and Lendl, Connors. So it was just something I really enjoyed doing. I think my dad hit the nail on the head. I remember I was playing a little bit of tennis, hadn't been exposed to any lessons or anything, went over to a friend's house for just like, you know, I was 9 years old, like you said, I was just a play date. And my buddy's mom said, you know, the guy's name was Jay. He's like, Jay, I totally forgot. You have a tennis lesson today. Paul, would you mind going and just sort of watching, you know, with Jay? So he took this lesson for an hour. He and I went and hit on the court right next to Nancy after the lesson. And that's when I came back and said, yeah, I'd like to take some lessons. And so that's how I got into it. And, you know, one thing I think about our family, even though I told our brothers who are real active, none of them really got that into tennis. And so, you know, we never skipped any step along the way.
Right.
You know, first tournament we played was like a 10 and under silver flight tournament. You know, then played some tournament and turned out it was like a Maryland State Championship. And it was like, oh, my gosh, we got a chance to, you know, win the Maryland State. And then there was a sectional tournament. And then there was a national tournament. And then international. And then college. I mean, from every, we just never skipped a step. Not because we thought that was the right way to do it. You know, no credit here. It's just we didn't know any better. You know, a lot of guys now going straight to the tour or straight to international events, and we didn't know any better. So it just so happened that we didn't skip any steps along the way.
Well, I want to acknowledge something there for everyone out there listening, that you're probably about the fifth person, and the company is pretty lofty. You know, Alan Fox, who's an NCAA champ, Martina Navratilova. We've heard from all kinds of players who started on a wall. So there's a common theme there about the players that started the wall. But when you started playing the tournaments, and Clark, as he started getting into the sport, and Paul, as you started to play the tournaments, and there was no team, and you were the team, you had to take your own kid, you had to pay for their own lessons. Was there a game plan drawn up, or you were just winging it as you went?
Well, it certainly wasn't a game plan. There were some tournaments in the Washington area. We went to them, and then when we got involved in the Mid-Atlantic, we started playing in those tournaments. It wasn't until I think Paul's second year in the 12 and under that he went to the Nationals. And from then on, he just managed to go to almost all the Nationals through the 18s.
But and was the path to the Nationals through the section at that time?
Yes.
You know, I think that might be with Paul, what you might have been alluding to before. It seems like a lot of kids now skip out of the sectional competition to try to get to the national events, and it seems like a disservice to not have to fight your way out of the section. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm going to take it one further. I think there are too many guys now skipping the national and going straight to the ITF events. And I just think it's like the tour is hard enough traveling around the world when you're trying to do it to make a living. To play a 25, 30-week international schedule as a 16, 15-year-old, whatever the case may be, before you get on tour and you're committed to doing this to make your living, I think is ludicrous. I think it's way too early. I was very fortunate when I was 16, 17 to have the opportunity to travel a little bit internationally. It was fantastic, but it was, you know, maybe to the, you know, maybe 6 weeks out of the year, 7 weeks out of the year, just enough to sort of get you exposed to some red clay tennis and some international competition, which is very valuable. but wasn't trying to play a 25-week schedule, ITF schedule. I think you develop yourself locally, and when you're ready, expose yourself a little bit out there if you want to. But you know, when you don't need to be out there playing international full schedule until you're ready to win matches and you're ready to, you know, make it your career.
Well, it's been suggested by me that, you know, you should win everything in your own backyard before you move on to playing somebody else's, and I like what you're saying about it, but I like to take it a step further and say that, you know, let's look at your junior career, which is, you know, you come along and you win Kalamazoo, the Nationals in the 16s, your second year, then both years of the 18s. That's an incredible accomplishment. While you're doing that, you go off to college then and you win for 4 years. You're part of a program that wins 4 NCAA championships. So I'm going to say that there's a blueprint here. And if someone called you up today, you know, Clark is the father, first year, and then Paul is the son, and you were going to give them an outline of what that looked like in terms of timings. At what age did you develop what? What was missing? What would you need more of? What does kind of the blueprint look like that got you to where you got to? Clark, what did it look like from the parent side, the blueprint? How much to play? How many tournaments? How often?
Well, I think when Paul was in middle school and in high school, up until maybe his last year of high school, he played, I guess it averaged, and Paul could correct me, but it averaged about 2 weekends a month that he played in a tennis tournament. I'm not talking about practicing. I'm just talking about playing in a tennis tournament, locally or nationally or whatever it is. And I think that was a healthy balance, because not only did he have the ability to play competitive tennis, but he also had a life outside of tennis. And to us, that was very important, because it's so easy to get consumed with this sport. And I'm not so sure that's necessarily a healthy way to grow up. So I think it worked out that we did it right. I'm not so sure we planned it that way, but that's right. The way his schedule worked out.
I mean, is that what you would call, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, if there's one theme from my sort of amateur career, I would call that theme sort of balance. It's balance between, you know, your academics, your social life, and your tennis, and you understand that each one of those three are going to be sacrificed at some level. But from a holistic standpoint, it was something that was, you know, important to me, and that was because it was important to, you know, mom and dad, and they instilled those values in me. And so throughout, you know, the amateur career, I refer to all the way through college, it was about striking the balance as best as possible. Now, we'll never know if I'd committed a little bit more to tennis, maybe, you know, a little bit better results. Or I committed a little bit more to tennis, got burned out, and worse results. I mean, it's just something we'll never know.
Went
to the three every day, got my tennis in after school, maybe appreciate the time I did have on the court, particularly growing up back east, indoors, maybe only an hour a day, but maybe try to get the most out of that hour a day as best as possible. And, you know, the fact that I played other sports, I think, till 13 or so, I think really helped me develop my tennis game in terms of footwork and hand-eye coordination. And I'd certainly encourage folks to play other sports, and, you know, up until a certain point.
Well, we know the eye-hand coordination had to be good with a dad who's a U.S. Open ping pong champion. You didn't know I knew about that, Clark, huh?
That was a long time ago.
In 1937, when you were in high school, maybe, huh? But so the coordination we know is good, but let's say, Paul, tennis wasn't the thing for you. You know, what other sport was it that you really loved?
I miss baseball.
What position did you play?
Loved it. Played third base. Loved it.
Did you ever consider trying to play in high school at all and taking the spring off of tennis, or wouldn't it work?
I mean, I played the other sports through middle school when your sports activity was for the most part during the school day. Maybe you'd have games after school. Once you got to high school and practice and everything was after school, at that point I was pretty committed to my tennis, and at that point I really was just focused exclusively on tennis, except for the occasional maybe pick up basketball game or something.
Right. So let's rewind the clock. And you'd said, you know, maybe if you put a little more time in, or maybe if you did this, or maybe if you did that. You know, what do you think was lacking from your game? Not that I'm criticizing your career. It was phenomenal, and anybody would love to have it. But, you know, what kept you from being
There's lots to criticize, Bruce. Don't worry about it.
No, there's nothing here. I can't throw stones. But, you know, what part of your game, I mean, certainly your mental game is reputed to be as good as anyone's. But is there a part of your game, you know, Clark, when he was younger, would you have tried to get him to play in the front court more? Or, Paul, is there something in hindsight you wish you'd have done? What does it look like? What were you missing to get to the next level, to be top 20 instead of top 50?
Well, I'll take it first, Dad. But, you know, you mentioned that one Kalamazoo 93-94 in the 18s. And as you know, when you do that, you get a wild card into the U.S. Open. So when people said, why didn't you go straight on tour? Well, I got a wild card in the U.S. Open and really got my clock cleaned after winning both those wild cards. So from a physical maturation standpoint, I think I didn't feel like I was ready. And I think those experiences playing in the Open each of those years proved that I wasn't physically ready to sort of compete at the next level and win consistently. So that was one thing that, you know, I wish I'd developed a little bit better. Once I got on tour, I think I understood my strengths pretty well in terms of being a tough out, you know, making a guy play one more ball, not beating myself, forcing my opponent to beat me, trying to have a 30-ball rally on the first point of the match just to let that guy know that I'm going to be here all day. You can beat me, but I'm not going to beat myself. So I think I understood that those were my strengths. I think if I had one sort of regret as I got out on tour, it's when I put myself in a position to win, that's when I would get more tentative. So when I was up a break, serving for a set, serving for a match, those were the times when I felt like I could have been more effective.
Sure. Clark, where does that toughness come from? I mean, you got a kid who is as fine a human being as I've ever known, yet you put him out on a court and he'll fight you to the death. How do you develop the toughness like that, or is that just, was he born this way?
Well, I don't think, not only was he born that way, but, you know, ever since we paid for the first lesson, I always felt that we got our money's worth. I mean, if it was an hour lesson, he was out on that court for 1 hour, and he worked hard. He listened to the pro. He did what the pro said. I mean, he was an ideal student, and I think that carried on through high school. It carried on through college, and it carried on in the pro tour. I mean, he's right. He wasn't going to beat himself. You had to beat him, and he was that way from ever since he started playing competitive tennis. I mean, he'd be out there all day. He wouldn't care. And I think that's innate. I mean, that's something that he developed himself. And I don't think we had anything to do about it. And I think,
Bruce,
it's helped him.
Bruce, I'd beg to differ on a little bit. You can talk all you want about it being innate, but I really truly believe that those are values instilled in me by my parents. And a couple of examples I can think of. One, you know, my dad, it's true, had to make many sacrifices in his own work to take me to those tournaments twice a month or whatever the case may be, or drive me to Winston-Salem, North Carolina to play a tournament. And it's an expensive sport, and he'd pay for lessons, he'd pay for clinics, whatever the case may be, he'd pay for travel. And not once did he ever equate results with the amount of money that he was having to spend on me and the sport. And I didn't appreciate that until now, until much later. But I can imagine how difficult it would be if he were to say, oh, Paul, you lost. I'm not going to spend the money because your results aren't there. And I think from his perspective, it's probably as long as the effort is there, it's money well spent. But he never equated those two, so I never felt that. And so it's something I appreciated very much. The other thing is I remember a time I was playing with a buddy of mine at the local park. I can't remember how old I was. I might have been 9, I might have been 10. And we were playing, and my dad came to watch, you know, the last 20 minutes to pick us up, whatever the case may be. And we're playing a set, and I can't remember. At one point, I missed the ball. I threw my racket on the ground. And, you know, we finished. Dad took us for ice cream, drove my buddy home, drove me home. Later that night, He said, Paul, that kind of behavior on the court throwing your racket is unacceptable. The racket's going on the shelf for a week or 2 weeks, whatever the case was. So I wasn't able to play for the next week. And by handling it that way, but not embarrassing me in front of my friend, but by letting it sit for a little bit and making it clear that that behavior was unacceptable, it resonated a lot more strongly than if he had done something right there on the court. And it's something I'm talking about now, 26 years later, as opposed to something that I would have just forgotten. So, you know.
I'm just hoping that Sadie doesn't throw a toy coming up soon that she likes to play with so that you don't take it away from her.
That ship has sailed. She's always a flock.
Clark, it sounds like what Paul's talking about, which is the ultimate value to have as a human being, an athlete, a student, is accountability. Sounds like Paul was holding himself accountable for his own tennis, for a standard of behavior. Did you guys used to talk about that as a father and a son, or you just led by example, or where does that come from?
You know, if we talked about it, the only way we talked about it was in reference to somebody else whose behavior, in our opinion, was unacceptable. I don't think we ever talked about it as it relates to Paul. And part of the reason is I cannot remember Paul ever getting a warning. He might have gotten one in his whole career, but I can't remember him getting a warning. I think that one thing that is that Patty and I, my wife and I, are very proud of is the number of sportsmanship awards that he did win, not only in junior tennis, but in college. He won the Rafael Osuna Award, the Arthur Ashe Award, and these are awards that are given nationally by the NCAA to tennis players that excel not only academically, but in tennis. And, you know, those things, you know, as parents, you can feel an accomplishment in that. My accomplishment in his tennis is that as a parent, as a spectator. But we do feel that maybe we did have something to do with a lot of his sportsmanship awards that he won. And we're very proud of that, as we should be.
But if I certainly think it is, it speaks volumes to parenting, having children of my own. Although when my kids don't behave, that doesn't mean I'm a bad parent, though. So let's just get that clear. It's only when they do behave. But let's look at a match. You know, here's Paul playing, you know, at a match somewhere in college, Kalamazoo, it doesn't matter because I think the parent feels. If we have a split screen, you know, while your son's out playing a match, and a lot of parents, they leave, they can't watch, they like to watch, all kinds goes on. What went on with you when Paul played in your mind, in your heart, in your head?
Well, first of all, you got to understand that I enjoy watching tennis.
Okay.
I always have. I mean, to this day, I still watch it. So I enjoy watching it. Certainly I enjoy watching my son win, but I think more than that, I do enjoy watching him compete, both mentally and physically. And I enjoy that. My wife gets a little nervous at that, and she's got to sit around and talk to people because she can't just concentrate on the match. But I enjoyed it, and I think it's the same for his brothers. His brothers take a great deal of pride in watching him play, and they always did. So I think we had a pretty good balance there. But if I was there, I wanted to watch him play.
And Paul, from the competitor side, you know, so many kids, you know, have a great deal of talent, and so many pros have tons of talent. We've all seen guys ranked 300 in the world who can hit every shot, but never actually break through. What would go on in your mind? What do you find is your train of thought when you're playing that helps you manage the stress out there in a match situation and keeps you to be able to put your best foot forward without breaking down or getting upset or throwing the racket or blaming an umpire or a bad call? What goes through your head?
That's a tough question. I mean, I think a lot of it is instinctive. I mean, the one thing I think I'll say is I completely concur with your sentiment early on that you win in your own backyard before you start playing in other people's backyards. And I think it's very important at all levels, not only in the developmental stages and juniors, but at the professional level as well, it's really important to win and to get that positive feedback. So when you are in a situation where it's 5-all, 30-all, you're not panicking. You know, you've been there before. And so you can control that to a certain extent in the juniors by, you know, making sure you're, you know, trying to win two out of every three matches you play. And if you're not, then maybe you need to dial it down to a lower level below. But getting in the habit of winning is really important. And for the talented guys who just go out and try to play the biggest tournaments and play up and aren't necessarily having successful results, it can stunt your development, I think.
Sounds like you're talking about really developing a strong belief system in yourself before you're in a situation that can be real stressful out there competing.
Yeah, I think you got to develop that, and that's what's going to help you when you get into those, you know, super competitive situations.
Well, we've got we get some emails here during the show, and I just got an email from someone that said they have a child who plays tennis, and they find their greatest joy in their child that plays tennis is that in the world today it's busy, and they have time in the car together. They have time to talk in the car on the way to lessons. They have time to talk in the car on the way to tournaments. Clark, is that something that you found? And Paul, in looking back and having a child of your own, do you realize what a value that was? Clark, go ahead first.
Well, you know, I enjoy all the time that I get to, and I still do enjoy all the time I get to spend with my three sons, whether it be in the car, wherever it is. And I think my wife and I both feel the same way today. I mean, we look forward to the conversations with him then. We look forward to it. I don't think it's just, in my case, it's just going to a tennis tournament. I think it was whatever we did together. We went to the movies. We went to visit somebody. You know, to be with my kids was a joy and a pleasure to both of us. So I don't think it's limited just to tennis.
Right. Paul, looking back, there's a lot of time that, you know, you get to a certain age and kids are busy and, you know, but you seem to spend, you know, tennis players seem to spend a great bit of time with their parents. You have to be driven places. You're going to play tournaments. You're sharing hotel rooms. You're in the same room. You know, looking back on that, do you feel that a lot of that brought extra value that at the time you didn't really account for?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, my dad's point is really well taken. We obviously enjoy any type of interaction we get with them, always have. But I do think there's something to be said for the unique characteristics around tennis that do give you some of those, do give you some more sort of close-knit time that you wouldn't have otherwise been exposed to. I mean, and these are memories that I have now, again, 25 years later. I mean, until I got my license, I'd take the subway after school every day. My mom would pick me up almost every day and drive me to tennis practice. And even if it's just 20 minutes or, you know, Washington traffic, 45 minutes in the car, there's time spent there. Oftentimes, my dad would pick me up on the way home and maybe get there for the last 10 minutes of a lesson and, you know, pick up the balls for the last 10 minutes of a lesson or something like that. And that's, again, that's time that I remember today. I mean, I remember driving to Winston-Salem with my mom when we were 12 years old. I remember my dad at the Midtown Tennis Club in Chicago in the 14 and unders. So, you know, the 14 under national championships. I remember Kalamazoo, my parents being there. So you do get a lot of this time. And these are, you know, these are some of the fondest memories that I have today. So I think there is something to be said for tennis providing some of those, affording some of those opportunities.
Bruce?
Clark, what do you think the role?
I just have one thing to say.
Sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
One of the happiest days in my life, in my life and my wife's life, though, was when Paul got his driver's license.
Yeah. You didn't have to chauffeur anymore.
No. I mean, that helped a lot.
That will help. What do you think the role of the parent is? And Paul, in hindsight, how it looked like? And what I mean by that is, there are some tennis programs which don't want parents going anywhere near the court. Me personally, I like the parents to be a part of everything, the lessons, the skull sessions, everything we do, because they're the one taking the kids to the tournaments and, you know, I'm not going with them as the coach. The parent's kind of the coach, the support, but what is the role of the parent? I mean, how much is the parent, Clark, should they push? Hey, did you hit your serves? Have you done your running? Do you have matches set up? I mean, what's the role of the parent in the development of the player?
Well, you know, it's kind of hard for me to say because I think Paul was very self-motivated. So we didn't have to motivate him. I think the role of the parent, especially in our case, because I knew nothing about tennis, was to be supportive. What can I do to help you? I mean, I could, there's not much I can do except stand there and when he's going to practice his serve or return the ball sometimes. But there's not really much I can do. I sort of felt that I didn't want to be there to watch the lessons necessarily. And the reason is I wanted my son concentrating on the pro. I didn't want him looking at his parent every time he missed a shot. And knowing he disappointed his parent or something. I wanted to get as much money, my money's worth out of that pro as I could. And I think that without the parent being there, it's possible for the player and the coach to get more accomplished. Because the pro doesn't have to satisfy the parents. He's there to improve the kid.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always, I mean, what we usually did is my wife would drive him to the tennis lesson or the clinic or whatever it was, and I'd pick him up later on when he was finished. And I think that worked out pretty well for us. I can't say I never watched a tennis lesson, but I don't think I ever watched one from beginning to end.
So Paul Sadie comes home and says, I want to play tennis, Daddy. I want to be good like you. What's your role? You able to be as hands-off as Dad was?
I think I would. I mean, look, I don't think there's a right answer to this question. I'm certainly supportive of, my kids playing tennis, and I'm out there with them on the weekends as often as they want to be there, certainly not forcing it down their throats. That said, there are a lot of different models out there that have had, varying degrees of success. I mean, a lot of our champions had parents that were highly involved, right? And think of like a Maria Sharapova, Mark Philippoussis, Monica Seles, I think. I mean, these are parents who are deeply, deeply involved and helped them achieve some, amazing results on the tennis court. I think one thing I can say affirmatively is that the approach my parents took, the balanced approach that they took, has resulted in an extraordinarily healthy relationship between me and my parents, between me and my dad. That's the only thing I can really say definitively.
Well, it sounds like certainly you are self-motivated. Well, we're going to jump real quick to a commercial here. When we come back, we've got some folks. We've got a couple 240 numbers. We've got a 516 from Florida, folks who are waiting on hold that probably have some questions for you. Anyone else out there wants to call in? We're at 714-583-6853. Guys, just stay with me for a minute. We're going to jump to a quick Nike Tennis Camp commercial, then we'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm the Bruce Lipka Show on Blog Talk Radio.
This is Jason Haynes, the UR Tennis Network's Chief Executive Officer. Over the last 14 months, we have undergone a lot of changes here at the UR Tennis Network, and the Nike Tennis Camps have been one of our strongest supporters. They have had a very successful 2012 summer camp season and now are planning for 2013. We would like to thank them for allowing us to be an advertising avenue for their tennis camps. As we leave the summer, we want to encourage you to check out www.ussportcamps.com and start planning your next Nike camp experience. They have locations all over the U.S. for both adults and juniors. The Nike camps are offered in other sports such as golf, volleyball, soccer, swimming, softball, running, water polo, lacrosse, and field hockey. We want to encourage you to consider the Nike camp experience for your tennis needs. These camps are run by successful tennis coaches and offer a fun camp involvement where you learn new skills and make new friends. Be sure to check them out at www.ussportcamps.com or call them at 1-800-NIKE-CAMP and take your game to the next level.
right, folks, welcome back to the show. We appreciate you spending some time with us today. We are with Clark Goldstein and Paul Goldstein here talking a lot about parenting roles, tennis, junior tennis. Guys, before we make the transition to our next topic, we've got a couple calls, and I'm not the greatest technologically here, and every now and again I mess it up a little bit, but I'm going to grab some calls here and see if someone's on the line. I've got a 516-236 number. Are you on the line? Did you have a question or a comment? 516-236, are you there? Okay, see, that's what I'm telling you guys. Sometimes they don't have comments. I've got a local number here. Let me try this one. Got 240-743. Are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
That's you, Colin?
That's me. How are you guys?
Good. Welcome to the show. Paul Clark, we got Colin Parker here with us today on the phone.
How are you, Colin?
Doing well, guys. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Got something for the Goldstein tandem here?
Yeah, definitely. First, I want to say it's nice listening to your show, Bruce. We're doing a great job, and it's nice to hear Paul and Clark out there. But I wanted to ask, or I thought it would be interesting to hear Paul and Clark comment on the competitive nature of the game today, speaking from the junior side, and what do you like with the changes that have gone on in the USTA juniors today, and what things might you change?
Clark, are you guys, you want to jump in there first?
I just wanted to ask Colin a real quick question, what he was thinking back when I was about 10 years old, and he used to stick me in his tennis bag and carry me around Linden Hill.
It's love. That was love, Paul.
That was
just nothing
love.
But love.
We didn't even know him as Paul then. We referred to him as Puppet Magic because we said he's not really human. He's like, he used to do cartwheels on the court, and we said he's like a little puppet, and he's magical because he's obviously pretty good at this game.
Well, your foreshadowing was good. He turned out to be pretty good. what do you make of, and I think, Colin, some of the changes he's referring to, Paul, you might have touched on a little bit before, but, folks dropping out of school, not playing in their section, afraid of, hiding from players, things like this, all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take it. I mean, I certainly go back to it. I think we need to be in a win in your own backyard before you move into somebody else's backyard mentality. Win locally before you win nationally. Win nationally before you win internationally. I think, despite, a lot of really good intentions, I think there's like a chasm between, the USTA and a lot of juniors and local coaches out there, which I think really needs to be addressed, and it's unfortunate. I think we have got to create a culture of accountability and not a culture of entitlement. And so those are sort of the themes that I would focus on.
Clark, any comments there?
I don't really know what's happening today as much as I know when Paul was playing, but, one of the things that I think we can't overlook, and that is, we have to develop a human being. I think it's important to develop a well-rounded person because, let's face it, in Kalamazoo, there's 196, I think, kids that compete nationally in that tournament. There might be four or five of them that actually go on to the pro tour. The rest of them go do whatever things in life they want to do. So I think it's very important that we develop the overall human being. And, sometimes in the mix of the efforts to develop your tennis skills, that's neglected. It's neglected not only from an academic standpoint, but it's neglected from a social standpoint. And, for somebody to drop out of school at 15 so they can play on the tennis circuit, that's a tough situation because if they don't make it, they're going to have a tough time in life. So I think
To your credit, we had Emilio Sanchez with us last week, and he said that if his group of juniors who he played with in Spain, he wasn't necessarily the highest ranked guy, but he was the only one who finished school because all the other fellows thought that they'd just make it as a tennis player, and then he ended up being, you know, more prepared, at least when the time came for the next stage.
Oh,
so
I
that's
mean,
what
that,
he's
that,
in there.
That, I think
to be, but to be clear, I don't, and I don't think anyone else would begrudge a guy like Andy Roddick, who at 18 was clearly developing and on a path where he could make an impact on tour in a short period of time, and a Marty Fish and a Robbie Ginepri, these guys who didn't finish school. And best example from my perspective is a Jim Courier, who didn't finish school but educated himself, taught himself a new language, is one of the more well-balanced and well-rounded individuals I know. There are ways to balance your life out without necessarily going the traditional route and with still being able to pursue your dreams. I certainly agree with my dad, and I think the majority of folks are behooved or are benefited by spending some time in school, and that's what I did. But there are those exceptions out there, and certainly no one would begrudge a guy like an Andy Roddick or a Jim.
No, well, certainly we can't argue with the success that those players have had both in their personal development and athletically. But who knows? If we turn you pro at 18 and put you on a regimented diet of higher caloric intake and some sort of higher training methods, and you mature more physically, it's a question that will never be answered, but it doesn't have to be because, hey, you know, went to college, got an education, met your wife, and, you know, it sounds like a happy ending to me.
We're trying.
So, you're doing just fine. Thanks for calling in there, Colin. I got a couple emailed questions in here. I got one here, Paul. Why Stanford when it came time for college? Why'd you choose Stanford, and how much of your college decision was your family a part of?
It ended up being a really easy call for me. I felt like at the time Stanford was a really excellent balance of academics academics and tennis. Got out there and the East Coast. I don't know if anyone's ever been out to Stanford, but it's an awfully pretty campus. And so when I got there, that place for the most part sold itself, and had an opportunity to, you know, meet Coach Gould on the recruiting trip, and it became a very seamless decision for me, and was very fortunate to be given the opportunity to go there, and had just a wonderful experience. I have so much respect and appreciation for Coach while I was there, but even more so now.
Where else did you visit?
I didn't take any other official recruiting trips,
that was it, huh?
Where my mind was at. I ended up playing a series of – so when I was a junior in high school, I had an opportunity to go play the Junior Australian Open. And it was right around sort of midterms, and junior year was a very important year academically, and so I passed on the opportunity to go play the Junior Australian. And at the time I did so, I went to the principal of my high school and said, look, you know, this is what I'm doing. I just want you to know that, you know, these are the types of opportunities I want to try to take advantage of my senior year and really focus on academics my junior year. And so having set that expectation come senior year when you're supposed to be doing those recruiting trips, I remember I went and played a series of tournaments that used to be called a satellite. And right during the recruiting, when I would otherwise be doing the recruiting, so I ended up only doing one. I sort of asked myself the question. I was like, what could possibly happen anywhere else to have me not want to sort of take the opportunity at Stanford, and just couldn't come up with a good reason not to just be done with it and move on.
Clark, while all that was going on, did you have any thoughts that you kept to yourself, or Paul was driving again?
Well, you know, we were fortunate from the standpoint that Paul was a pretty good academic student, and he was certainly highly ranked in the tennis world, so he could have probably gone to any school that had a tennis program in the United States. And, you know, my feeling was, if he can go to Stanford and get a degree from Stanford, that's worth something. And I was just so encouraged when they wanted him, and he seemed to want them, because to me it was a perfect mix. It's a superb school, one of the finest schools in the world.
Yeah.
And they had an excellent tennis program. So the combination of the two, as far as I was concerned, was a win-win.
Right.
And I think my wife felt the same way, and his two brothers felt the same way. And, yes, it was far away. The one regret I have is that Northern California is such a great place that my son lives there now.
Right.
That's one regret I have.
You let him go there and he didn't come home.
Yeah, but I must say the most important thing about him going to Stanford was that he met his wife there. And I think that's the most important thing.
Well, good.
Yeah.
All right. We got a call that just came in. It's a 434-817 number. Let's see if they got a question for you here. 434-817, are you on the line?
That's me, Bruce.
Who's
Can
me?
Can you hear me?
Ah, Davey, how are you?
That's me. I'm good, man. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Did you have a question for Paul and Clark here?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, it's a great show. Thank you. As a coach of some aspiring juniors, I'm interested in some information about how to best manage some or encourage that they manage some of their limited or more limited finances in training a young potential champion. And if given a limited budget, how do you best encourage parents to spend money toward getting their child to be a future champion? I mean, that may be a broad question, but
that's
not everybody
question.
Can afford to get, you know, something like that. What do y'all think on how to best encourage parents to invest?
Where's the best place to, Davey, thanks for calling in. It's a great question there. I'm going to throw you on mute here while they take a run at it. You know, where should the money be spent, you know, on a junior? If you have a limited budget and it's either, you know, lessons or it's travel or whatever it might be, where should the money be spent?
Well, it's a tough question because, first of all, there is a limited amount of money. Certainly, to a certain extent, if there's good clinics around, the clinics are cheaper than individual lessons. And so maybe he could spend a little more time on the clinics and then go to a lesson maybe once or twice a month rather than once or twice a week and go to the clinics. It depends, again, on the weather. You know, when we lived in Washington, you know, 4, 5, 6 months of the year, you really couldn't play outdoors. You could only play indoors, and indoor courts are expensive. But
yep.
When you can play outdoors, find competitive people to play with and play with them or form your own groups and play with them. And parents can do that. You know, parents can get together with 2 or 3 or 4 kids and play singles, play doubles. And I think that type of competitiveness is good, and it's not that expensive.
Right.
From a traveling standpoint, you know, as long as you travel in your section, it's not
yep.
that expensive. Once you have to start flying and hotel rooms in big cities, that does get rather expensive. But I think you have to budget yourself, and if there's 5 or 6 national tournaments, I'm only going to go to 1 or 2.
Right.
And so I think there are ways to do that, and if you are good and you're picked up by the USTA, then they will help you along the way. They helped us to a certain extent when Paul got into high school. And they have, when he was younger than that, they did invite him to different clinics that were sponsored by the USTA. So I think the USTA is there. At least when Paul was in the juniors, he was. I don't know, but I assume they're still there now. So I think there are ways to do it. And with limited resources, yes, the young man has to do more of it on his own. But I think
Paul,
he can for a young lady.
Sure. Paul, looking back at the juniors, is there anything that you could have done a little more of that didn't cost anything, and anything you could have done a little less of that did cost things?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. It's a fair question. It's a difficult question. I think the one thing I would emphasize here is that one of the best things you can do for your development is to go out there and compete against, you know, the best players within your area, and just don't duck the best players in your area on the practice court. You're going to get better if you guys practice against each other and play sets and matches against each other. One of the most valuable things we did, and if Colin Parker's still listening, his brother Steve Parker was a coach in the area, and what Steve used to do every Sunday, 5 to 7, 5 to 8, something like that, he used to just hit the best guys in the area, get them together in one bubble. I think it was 4 courts, maybe 6 courts, and just split them off and play sets against each other. That's it. Yep. Get the best guys together, play sets. If you can do it at a public park, it doesn't cost a thing. If you got to rent out a bubble, hopefully you're splitting the cost, and that's a more cost-effective way of getting something done. But just compete against each other. If it's the two best kids in the area, I encourage you guys to play against each other, practice against each other. You're going to be better for it. I don't care that you got to play each other in a tournament the next week or 2 weeks later. It builds character. It's what you should be doing. Play against each other. Practice. Compete.
I think it's great advice. Kids don't play enough sets today. You know, maybe I think they're a little too focused on clinics, on lessons. I find it hard to believe, though, that if Nancy was teaching you and the sun was out outside, regardless of the temperature, you weren't outside playing. But maybe she was softer back then, but I doubt it. We got another call here. Let's jump to this line here and see if they've got a question. 847-471, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, welcome to the show. Hi. How can we help you today?
Oh, thank you very much. I just wanted to ask Paul, as great as he was, I mean, obviously he was one of the best challenger players of all time, called Crash Davis, and he had a great career. Did he ever feel disrespected in the tennis professional ranks in the sense that they would dismiss him as a journeyman? And he had an unbelievable career. He was often ranked, I think he was high ranking, was 58th in the world, and he was always a top four or five player in the United States. But they would talk about him on TV on a second or third round match like he's just a typical journeyman. And I always felt that there wasn't an appreciation for players like Paul Goldstein and guys like Michael Russell, who are tremendous pros who just aren't winning Grand Slams.
It's a great question. Thanks for calling in today. Paul, you want to feel that? Did you ever feel like maybe you didn't get the credit that you were due?
I appreciate the sentiment very much. I appreciate the call, and I appreciate sort of the thoughts behind valuing my career. Very kind. I didn't get the caller's name, but thank you very much for that call. Totally get where you're coming from. The Crash Davis thing is a little bit bittersweet, no doubt. But at some level, I think I probably understood where I was sort of in the pantheon of the game and understand that while I worked my tail off and felt like I got every ounce of got the best results out of my ability that I possibly could, I don't know that I ever really felt dismissed. I mean, at some level, I feel like if you want to be talked about the same breadth of some of these other guys, then you just, one thing about tennis, it's very much a meritocracy. And if you go out and you win a Grand Slam, then by golly, you're going to be talked about like a Grand Slam winner. And so I had that under my control. I mean, I didn't have any coach that was, not putting me in the lineup. I didn't have anyone holding me back. I mean, tennis is, two people on the opposite sides of the net, and better one on that day moves on to the next. So, felt like if I wanted better results, or excuse me, if I wanted sort of better recognition, then I had it within my power to achieve better results.
While you were out there playing, Paul, pro tennis, and, some people feel like, and Clark, you love tennis, you've been watching for years, some people feel like the United States is not a world leader in tennis anymore, and perhaps some other countries have been because they produce more players or more top 100 players. When you were out there traveling the world, did you find that tennis held a different emphasis in some places, so they're more likely to have more people playing in the U.S., or is this just the way things go?
There's definitely a different emphasis in some of the other countries. Apologies for jumping in there, Dad. It's a bigger sport. It's more on the lines of American football and a lot of these other countries. So there is a bigger emphasis and probably a greater appreciation for some of the journeymen like myself. And, one of the things, just to expand on my last answer on the guy's question, I don't think Andy Roddick, is given enough credit for his accomplishments in the game. Guy got to be number one in the world, U.S. Open champion, more than that, 9 years in a row, top 10 in the world. I mean, that's a remarkable accomplishment. And to suggest that if Federer wasn't around, he probably would have had 4 or 5 slams. But to suggest that he sort of didn't live up to any expectations or anything like that, I think is sad.
Well, it's, certainly it would be nice if we could figure out how to bring tennis more to the forefront in our country.
Yeah.
It is a great sport. It does a great job of preparing people for life. Clark, do you have any suggestions how we might be able to do that?
Well, to reissue what Paul says, you got to realize that we have so many sports in this country that are professional sports that the athletic ability, the athletes are driven in many different directions. And let's face it, it's much easier to go up to the playground and play basketball than it is to pay to go play tennis. You know, I mean, tennis is an expensive sport. If we could, one of the things we could do to improve the tennis, the athletes in tennis, is figure out a way to not make it so expensive.
Right.
I think that would be one way that we could do it. And I don't know how we can do that. I mean, we're going to need the help of the USTA to do it. And
well, they could do what some of the other countries do. You know, you travel to some of the other countries, they've got, you know, prize money available in junior tournaments. You know, that'll draw the kids from the playground.
Well, but they got to develop first. I mean, you got to develop the player first. I mean, it's a tough situation. I mean, it is. I think that. And then we were spoiled because we went through a period of time when we had Agassi, Sampras, Chang. We had Courier. We had great players that developed at the same age. That was a fluke. It doesn't happen. And it hasn't happened since, and it might never happen again. But we think that because we did that once, we should do it all the time. And it's just not going to happen.
What about the late bloomers, Paul? What's the latest you think someone, because we get a lot of kids who pick the game up, but not at the intense level that you did to play the tournaments, but they get to middle school, they get to seventh grade, and they want to choose, quote, a sport. And they're willing to put their, you know, 20 hours a week in and work hard. Is it too late at 12, 13 years old, or can these kids still reach their potential as a player? And if they do, what kind of work do they have to put in?
Well, unfortunately, I'm sort of in the Malcolm Gladwell camp of you got to put in your 10,000 hours. And to get to 10,000 hours, you know, you really do sort of have to start at a young age. I mean, the only example I can think of is a little bit of a late bloomer is a guy like Rafter, who, and I might have this wrong, but I think he really didn't pick it up seriously until he was like 14 or so. And that's the latest example I can think of. Unfortunately, it's a sport where you got to develop the muscle memory and small motor skills at a young age. So I think 12 is too late, not necessarily, but it can't go much later than that. If you want to sort of compete at the elite of the elite level at some point in your tennis life, that doesn't mean you can't play tennis at a high level for the rest of your life, and it can't be a sport for you for the rest of your life. But really, to achieve some of that elite level, I mean, there aren't too many examples of folks starting any time after 10, and generally 8 or 9. Doesn't mean that has to be the only sport you're playing, but you start to get exposed to it, and you start to develop the muscle memory.
Yeah, it seems like it takes 10 years, but, you know, you got to put in about 1,000 hours a year for 10 years to become a champion, but I'd be curious with an experiment someday if we took a person who was, instead of 10 to 20, if we took them from, 15 to 25. But at any rate, you guys, our time has flown by. I appreciate you guys coming on today. You know, Clark, before we finish up here, is there any message you want to impart to tennis parents out there?
Well, I don't know. I just think that it's go with the flow. Enjoy it. Just think of it as an experience. If your child is good, more power to you. If he's not the greatest, it doesn't matter. It's tremendous exercise. I think we overlook the competitiveness and the importance of the one-on-one competitiveness, because you know when you're out there in life, you know, you're always competing, and I think the competition in tennis has done well for Paul. It's taught him how to compete, and it's taught him how to lose. You know, we forget that. You know, losing is sometimes losing is more important than winning.
I got really good at that as a tennis player, Clark, by the way. You'd be proud of me.
I'm still good at it as a tennis player.
I'm world class in that. Paul, aspiring kids out there want to play tennis, relationship with mom and dad, tournaments, the whole dynamic. You have advice for the young tennis players out there?
I'm not so good at dispensing advice. I'll say that I feel very fortunate for what tennis has given to me. I would emphasize sort of this culture of accountability, being responsible for your own results, being responsible for your own development, being responsible for your own training. I encourage all parents out there to support their kids as much as possible. And that's it. I mean, I've been very fortunate, had a great experience.
Well, I'll agree with you both 100%. Great advice from dad, great advice from son. No wonder your relationship is as good as it is, and no wonder you both are thriving as much as you are. Can't thank you enough for coming on the show today and sharing a little bit of yourselves with our listeners. You know, hopefully, Paul, when you come home again, I owe you lunch for this one. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bruce.
Bruce,
thanks,
thank
guys.
You.
You guys have a great day.
All right. We enjoyed it.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay,
bye.
All right, folks, that's our show today. We thank Paul and Clark Goldstein for coming on. It was a great show. Next week, we are going to have on our show one of the famous French coaches, Jacques Hervé, who's going to talk a little about tennis in Europe, tennis in France, the French ranking system, a little bit about what's different over there versus over here. But as popular as tennis is over there, still no Grand Slam champions in a long time. Thanks for listening to us today, and have a great day and make it a better tomorrow.
Opinions stated by various contributors to UR10's radio and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR10's network. Visitors are urged to use their own discernment to draw their own conclusions. All information, products, services, and use of this website is for personal use only. UR10's radio does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of the information contained within the website. Any services or products provided by UR10's radio and its hosts or contributors should be used solely for entertainment and enjoyment. We emphasize the importance of keeping an open mind and not construing the data, products, and/or services as factual.